Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Welcome to the Tattered Cover. We're so glad that you've come to support your independent bookstore, and I'm sure Dan is too, because he's affiliated with Explore Booksellers in Aspen, and last night appeared at Bookworm in Edwards, both independent. So now we can welcome him here tonight. With Dead Run, The Murder of a Lawman and the Greatest Manhunt in the Modern American West. This is something that in many ways is pretty timely even for today. There's so many issues that are relevant. Dan received his MA in journalism from the University of Minnesota and worked as a reporter and feature writer for daily newspapers in Minnesota and Oregon, covering crime stories before he began writing for magazines and television. After living in Aspen, Colorado for several years, where his wife Linda managed the other independent bookstore, Explore Booksellers, Dead Run is the first in-depth account of this sensational case, replete with overbearing yokel sheriffs, rumors, native trackers, posses on horseback, suspicion of vigilante justice, and police cover-ups, and the blunders of the nation's most exalted crime fighters pursuing outlaws into territory in which only they could survive. Much of that could be have been in yesterday's Denver Post. So let's welcome him and hear about this wonderful new book.
Thank you. First of all, really thank you very much for inviting me to the Tattered Cover. It is truly one of the nation's great independent bookstores. And then in addition, I know that bookstores are kind of a special place. They're really not just a retail environment. They're also part of the community. And so I really want to thank all of you for inviting me to your community. I will start by telling you a little bit about how the story came about and a little bit about the overall direction of the story. First of all, you could probably tell by my age that my formative years were spent watching cowboy shows on TV. So I had an overall fascination with the West. And when I was living in Aspen, there was a little three-paragraph story in the newspaper there in 2007 about the discovery of a skeleton in the Utah desert by a cowboy who had been herding cattle on horseback. And part of those remains included a skull with a bullet hole in it. So already it sounded like a great story, and to me it had a Western flair that I really liked. I started poking around, and the immediate thing that came out in the story was, first of all, you know, what had taken place, that this was connected with the crime that occurred in Cortez, Colorado in 1998, and it involved this gun-blazing chase and shootout, and then these outlaws disappearing into the same countryside where Butch Cassidy had disappeared at when he began his crime spree in the same area. So the western part of it really was another aspect of the whole story that was additional part of the western part that really drew me in. Then beyond that, the story had a lot of other dimensions as I started poking around on it. First of all, the manhunt was highly unusual. I'll give you a brief overview of the story. It began when a stolen water truck cruised through Cortez. There had been a police bulletin out to watch for that water truck. And now that's not an unusual thing. Water trucks in that part of the country are stolen relatively often. It's a crime of opportunity, but usually it's kids joyriding. They're the kind of things that are parked on construction sites with the keys, you know, tucked under the mat or under the visor. So they're easy thefts, and it's kids joyriding or perhaps, you know, a mild mannered eco-terrorism move where you move a water truck. But in this case, the officer came on duty that morning, saw the bulletin on the stolen truck, and happened to notice it cutting the corner of Cortez. He followed it as it left the city. It pulled over for him when he put on his flashing lights, but then one of the passengers jumped out of the truck with an AK-47 and murdered the officer rather brutally. There were many, many police in the area, despite the desolate location of the, or the apparent desolate location of the crime, and police immediately pursued the truck from multiple police cars. They abandoned the truck, commandeered a flatbed, and more or less blasted their way beyond multiple police cars, disabling them, kind of the typical movie scenario of shooting your way out of something. Estimates are that there were over 1,000 rounds of ammunition shot during that brief escape. And after that, they cruised rather nonchalantly over towards the Utah border, abandoned the water or the flatbed that they had commandeered, and disappeared into the desert. So, unfortunately, and certainly as recent events again make it evident, police officers get killed fairly often in the line of duty. Something about this particular killing, however, really galvanized the police brotherhood, and a manhunt of unbelievable proportions developed almost immediately. Amassed on the Utah border by that evening, the crime took place in the morning, by that evening there were already over 200 officers around the abandoned flatbed ready to search for the suspects. Within the next few days, that number swelled to over 500. Officers from all around the country converged on that area, many from Florida, from the city of Los Angeles. SWAT team came in, a full team came. Other officers came individually or with friends, where they take vacation days and drive from Florida and end up on this border ready to pursue these outlaws. The FBI, in total, more 75 different federal, state, and local agencies were involved in this, and more than 500 officers were involved, including U.S. Army Special Forces eventually. The story then developed a lot of other dimensions. In addition to the part of the Western, it became a true mystery. What were the outlaws after? And ultimately, why were all three of them found over a course of 9 years dead in the desert with a bullet hole in their skull? The second part, another dimension, is this story was a story of man against nature. These officers were arrived here and ended up in what could arguably be called the harshest climate on the continent. Temperatures in the desert at that time of the year exceeded 110 degrees. The terrain is extremely rugged, full of thorn bushes, rocks. It's unbelievable hills and boulders, and most of these officers were totally unprepared to be in this environment. Typically, an officer that might have arrived here from a city would have been used to pursuing an outlaw within an urban environment, a roadblock, you know, surrounding somebody, and 3 hours later they've got the situation under control. Instead, they were put into this desert, which was more or less a moon landscape to them. In unbearable heat, they were unprepared for survival in the desert, and of course that brought on its own set of problems. Then there's the story, I think, the dimension of individualism versus a technological society. The outlaws were three homegrown survivalists. They had trained themselves in military tactics and how to survive in the desert, and they were being pursued with the most sophisticated search technology available in the country, including aerial search by a FBI aircraft called Night Stalker, which up to that point had pretty much flown under the public's radar. They were airplanes jammed full of electronic equipment and search equipment. And to get a Night Stalker aircraft assigned to a crime required a significant effort because they were very limited on where they were put to use. But Night Stalker was used there. So it was a man kind of individualism versus technology story. And then finally there is that mystery part that I talked about before. So the story grew on it, and really that's what turned it into a book-length subject. I took the story from the point of view of the many different people involved. Within the Dead Run, you know, you'll read the story, but from the viewpoint of the officers and the commanders who were directing it, you'll read it from the viewpoint of the families of the suspects and the families of the victims. In told, in addition to Officer Dale Claxton, who was the officer murdered, there were three other police officers wounded in the course of the pursuit. I could read you, and there were also numerous witnesses to this story. And what for a reading, I just chose a section that talks about a couple of these witnesses. Oops, I have to do something since I talked about my age here. All right. Okay. "45 miles west of Durango, May 29th, 1998, began with mixed emotions for Kerry Evans. The exuberance of graduating from Cortez High School the previous evening, along with 201 other students, still flickered. But at the moment, a little after 9 a.m., she sat distracted in the rear seat of a black Camaro convertible, turning south onto Montezuma County Road 27 toward McAlmo Bridge on the way to have her wisdom teeth pulled. Not far away on the opposite side of McAlmo Creek, 16-year-old Matt Weston's day was already well underway. He'd already driven to school, where he was officially dismissed for the summer, and now was leaving again to pick up a computer desk at Kmart. Driving a silver Ford Explorer, he too would turn onto CR-27, converging on the bridge from the opposite direction as Kerry. Elsewhere in Cortez, others also gravitated toward McElmo Bridge. Michelle Dorn would reach it a few seconds ahead of Matt, Evelyn Pearson a few seconds after him. A garbage truck heading for the county landfill rumbled toward it. A mechanic working in the school district's bus barn 200 yards south of the structure paused, screwdriver in hand, and tipped his ear toward it. A DJ in the radio station up the road glanced out the window toward it. And at houses within earshot of McElmo Bridge, residents tending their gardens or half listening to the police scanner as they cleaned up breakfast dishes looked up at the distinct sound coming from it. Cortez City Policeman Dale Claxton's trajectory that morning also led him to McElmo Bridge. At the eastern edge of the city, where Main Street begins to reclaim its identity as Colorado State Highway 160, the ramp onto North Dolores plunges the motorist off the plateau of community and into the sagebrush fringes of civilization. In less than 200 yards, the road gives up 50 feet in elevation, crosses over the city limits, and merges onto County Road 27, a half mile north of McElmo Bridge. The city doesn't peter out, it ends. A short distance behind, but erased from sight by the plateau ridge, tree-lined boulevards front tidy yards and well-kept homes. Far ahead, pine-covered hills guarding Mesa Verde National Park frame the horizon. Between lay miles of low scrub and barren gravel wasteland. A dilapidated trailer house ringed with rusted appliances and vehicle parts sat 100 yards to the left of CR-27. Another dwelling occupied a dirt yard on the right side of the road, just beyond the bridge. Between them flows McElmo Creek. Even in the parched southwest, where men fight over water, it is a no-account stream, Under the bridge, a muddy, meandering trench crossable with a single wide step. The bridge itself is even less remarkable, a bridge only by the technicality that it spans the creek in a few feet of gully. From the perspective of an approaching driver, there is no visible structure of steel girders, creosote beams, or concrete buttresses. The roadbed neither narrows nor rises. Low guardrails and the falling away of land to each side of the road are the only clues that ahead there is a bridge at all. Robert Carpenter watched a white tanker truck roll slowly down Highway 160 past his auto repair shop. A police car followed a few feet behind. The truck was going 10 or 15 miles per hour, like it was having engine trouble or running out of gas, and the patrol car was escorting it, he told police. In his witness statement, Carpenter described watching the two vehicles for about half a mile until they turned south at County Road 27 and headed down the hill toward McElmo Bridge. It would have been about then that Claxton made his first radio call reporting that he had spotted the stolen vehicle. It was also at that time that Michelle Dorn crossed the bridge, driving south into town to meet her mother. Normally, she wouldn't have remembered a white truck coming toward her, but as she watched, the corner of a police car showed itself from behind the truck, the red and blue lights on its front bumper flashing. Her foot tapped the brakes. "I slowed," she said, "because I thought he was pulling the truck over for a ticket, and I didn't want to get one." As Michelle continued up the hill on the north side of McElmo Bridge, she glanced in her rearview mirror. The tanker and police car crossed the bridge and rolled to a stop. Matt Weston's silver SUV was approaching the bridge behind her. From 100 feet away, Matt could see the three men in the tanker's cab. In itself, nothing out of the ordinary. But as the distance closed between his explorer and the tanker stopped on the side of the road, he suddenly felt uneasy. Each occupant was wearing camouflage and holding what appeared to be rifles, barrels pointed towards the cab ceiling. Tightening his grip on the wheel, Matt kept his eyes focused on the tanker cab, searching for any flicker of movement. He couldn't explain what was wrong, but his instincts told him something bad was about to happen. He was nearly even with the tanker when the man in the passenger seat suddenly swung open the door, jumped from the cab, and ran toward the rear. A moment later, automatic gunfire crackled from behind the truck. Matt gasped. It was happening at that very moment, behind the tanker, and he dared not drive past it. Twisting the steering wheel violently to the right, he plowed the SUV into the ditch and drove the brake pedal to the floor. As his body snapped forward from the sudden stop, he looked out his side window. Directly across the road, the men in the tanker cab stared down at him from 20 feet away. "They watched me the whole time," Weston told police. In a motion that in retrospect was absurdly futile, he slunk lower behind the wheel, peered over the edge of the door, and witnessed murder from the knees down. Looking under the tanker, Matt could see only the lower legs and boots of the man who had jumped from its cab as he moved about at the rear of the truck. Another vehicle was stopped just a few feet behind the tanker, and although he could see little more than the front bumper, Matt knew it was a police car. Even in mid-morning sunlight, the reflected glow of the red and blue flashing lights strobed the space immediately in front of it. A second burst of shots sounded. The legs moved quickly to the left and disappeared from Matt's view. A third burst of shots. Matt later guessed he'd heard about 30 shots in all, but at the moment he wasn't counting. The legs reappeared. The man was running, moving swiftly back along the far side of the tanker, his boots kicking up little puffs of dust with each step. Matt shifted higher in the seat to maintain his view under the truck as the legs came closer. The legs stopped directly across from him, then disappeared as the man climbed into the cab. Weston knew he was about to die. "I was really scared," he recalled. "They killed that cop and now they were going to kill me because I saw them do it." From near point-blank range, he stared up at them, focused on the tip of the rifle barrel that the tanker's driver held, waiting for it to tilt downward at his head. In the deadly silence, it was the sudden scuffling sound of gravel moving that startled him from vacant resignation. Matt's eyes darted to the tanker's wheels. Rock and dust arced behind him. The tires bit and the tanker shot forward, accelerating past him. Matt didn't move for several seconds. Then, pulling onto the road, he slowly drove past the police car. "I didn't see anything inside, but the car was full of bullet holes," Weston reported. In his rearview mirror, he watched the water truck speed up the hill as he sped to the Circle S station and called 911. Evelyn Pearson, a 68-year-old grandmother, knew the driver of the silver SUV ahead of her was her neighbor, Matt Weston. Matt had been backing out of his driveway as she got into her car, and she'd been a short distance behind him since turning onto County Road 27. Knowing Matt was just 16, she didn't think there was too much he could do behind the wheel that would surprise her. But he did. I couldn't figure out what Matt was doing, slowing way down like that, then driving into the ditch, Evelyn said. But as she approached the vehicles, she too slowed and then stopped, right in the middle of the traffic lane, a few feet before the tanker. She locked eyes with the man climbing back into the cab of the truck. He knew I got a good look at him. We made eye contact, and I held it, Pearson told police as she described the suspect. As the tanker pulled onto the road and passed alongside her, Evelyn saw the police car that had been behind it. What she did next would leave her traumatized. Memory of the morning's events would fragment and slip deep into her subconscious mind to resurface as small pieces of terror in nightmares and flashbacks triggered by seeing a tanker truck on the highway or a police car on the side of the road. It would be several weeks of such episodes before she could assemble a cohesive recollection of that morning up to the last thing she did that day on McElmo Bridge. I pulled alongside the police car, got out, walked up, and looked in. So those are two of the witnesses, and there were many more in the whole course of this chase. I know that this is a crime that got a lot, great deal of national attention. All the national media held it, and in my research, I was not only looking at the Colorado papers, but the LA Times, the New York Times, Newsweek, Time Magazine. So it was widely reported, but I know it has particular resonance here in Colorado where it took place, where the headlines were biggest. And so I would be anxious to hear your thoughts about it and answer any questions that you might have. Yeah.
It was about 15 years ago, approximately. I'm just trying to, what was their plan? Were they going to do a stick-up or something? Or
There is supposedly a plan, yes. It was assumed this was a well, there was a plan. They had, the friends knew that they were going to do something. Exactly what their plan was is still somewhat in doubt. It hasn't been proven conclusively. At the time, police and authorities came up with a few different possibilities, motivation. In the book, I have selected one of those as what I believe has the most support for and seems most evident as their likely plan. And I can tell you that it would represent an act of terrorism of, if it were ever successful, of extreme proportions. The 1998 was just 3 years after the Oklahoma City bombing, and this would have been more significant than that.
Was there a theory about a casino being robbed?
That was kind of the upfront theory.
It's kind of dim in my mind.
Yes, that where there is a casino just a few miles from Cortez, and that was a theory. Even some of the officers that were key in the investigation have discounted that. The payroll at the casino, which was what they thought would be the target, or the cash, was not great. It was only about $220,000, which is a significant amount, but not significant enough for what they were doing. Second of all, it really made no sense to use a tanker truck, which has a maximum speed of 65 miles an hour in such a robbery. And then there's other evidence that suggests they had, in fact, a much grander plan in mind. Yeah.
What are the theories about the three of them being found in the desert, all shot in the head?
Police readily, immediately labeled each one of them a suicide. However, pathological evidence makes that highly unlikely, at least in two cases. In the third case, there wasn't enough of the skull left to really determine what had happened there. They could tell that it had been blown apart by an explosive force, but they did not have enough of a remains to really determine what had happened there. But in the two other cases, the pathology definitely suggested something other than suicide.
Yeah. One of the notes, the last time that we had some notes, which are really interesting, Dr. Book, about other people maybe being involved in the phone.
That was always a speculation that there were other people involved in this, that there was more of a conspiracy to it. Interestingly enough, I mentioned the three suspects were found shot in the head. The key, the prime fourth conspirator ultimately died, was within a year or two of this instance, was also shot in the head. And again, labeled a suicide. Yeah.
What was your biggest challenge in writing this book?
Well, I think from a personal standpoint, I was somewhat uncomfortable approaching some of the people in the book who had suffered, who this event represented a personal tragedy to. There were definitely cases where, you know, I'd have to sit in the car for a little bit and kind of, you know, take a couple of breaths and say, okay, I'm going to go in and ask these questions. And because I felt, to some degree, I was, you know, walking into it, invading their privacy. That said, the response from the people were generally quite nice and quite comfortable with it, though there were a couple people who declined, and it was very polite. And some of the people, for instance, one of the suspects, the mother of one of the suspects, has been most anxious for me to come and talk to her, and she's been the person who keeps emailing me saying, when is it going to come out? And because she feels that even though her son was an outlaw, and she's not denying his involvement in this crime, she feels that he was murdered in the desert and would like to see some justice. So, yeah.
When do they, for example, if something would be now CNN, Fox News, anything else would be out there interviewing all the neighbors and all of that kind of thing, any of that kind of reminiscing about how he was in high school?
There was. I mean, there was a great deal of news coverage on this, and people tried to approach it from, I think, just about every possible angle, you know, the human side. The interesting thing about the three suspects is that they really didn't have any police records. They didn't. They had, you know, each of them maybe a very minor teenage incident that was probably not way out of normal. So somehow these three kids, and they all came from pretty good families. I mean, there wasn't any track record that would say, oh, this kid is heading for trouble. And yet all three of them, for different motivations, ended up in this situation. And I do a lot, each of the suspects has a fair amount of background that I take them from their childhood up through the point where they disappeared into the desert. Well, I think one of the things that's fascinating about the manhunt and the helicopters and everything, first of all, the public was given the idea that this was a unified, coordinated manhunt, and it was anything but. From the very beginning, it was extremely contentious between the agencies. There were arguments. There were any number of blunders that were made in the pursuit of these three suspects. There was a lot of dispute over who was going to be in charge. That happened more at the county sheriff and the FBI level than at the Cortez Police Department level. It went just opposite of what you see on TV. Rather than the local police being resentful that the feds were coming in and taking over from them, the Cortez department had just been decimated by, it was a small department, extremely close, friendships and that, and they had just been decimated by the brutal murder of one of their officers. They were just numb. They were in shock. And the FBI arrived, and they said, well, we're not taking over. We're here to help. And so that was too bad. At that point, the FBI could have performed a better role by taking charge. And in fact, it kind of complicated things, because although they said they were not in charge, they also brought in tremendous resources immediately, which they directed. So they were tacitly in charge, but not officially in charge. And that created a lot of, I guess, false starts on it. So that was one aspect of it. And then, yes, they brought in listening devices, infrared cameras. They'd sit on canyon rims and try to listen for these suspects. They had tracking dogs. They had the most effective trackers were the Navajo police force, which really played a major role. The Navajo police force was by far the largest regional police force in that Four Corners area, much larger than any of the county sheriff's offices or the city police departments. Probably some of the better trained police as well, since many of them had gone out east for training under federal police academies and that. So we had that. There was, some politics involved. Some of the Navajo officers felt that they would track and get close or get everybody on the right track for towards these suspects. And then once that was, they thought they were close. Someone would make the call, direct the Navajo back, and then put in a SWAT team from out of the area, and hoping that, you know, the capture would go there. The ability of these suspects in this environment, first of all, they outgunned the police tremendously. These suspects had accumulated arsenals that are really hard to imagine, the number of weapons they had, many of them buried all around the desert. They had caches of ammunition and food supplies and survival supplies and guns all across the desert. They outgunned the police during that first shootout just dramatically. I think I forgot that next train of thought,
Was there a town evacuated in the course of this?
There was the manhunt involved evacuation of a town at one point. It involved burning of a canyon bottom and the idea of smoking them out, where they lined snipers along the rims of the canyons and hope that the fire would make somebody move down in the canyon bottom. I think the other thing that complicated the manhunt was there was a certain amount of arrogance on the part of the police that they did not want to give any credit to the capabilities of these suspects. That these were just three local boys, they were no match for all the police, and we would have them corralled and cornered in no time. And these people were survivalists and able to disappear into that desert area better than any of the police would be able to have found them. These were guys who, over years, had been visiting the desert as frequently as they could. They tried to live out there as often as they could, as much as their jobs would allow them. They would do things like do forced marches with no sleeping bags, minimal supplies, no tents. They would march into the desert until their water supplies ran out and then see if they could get back out. So they were very, very rugged at this.
How did you find out about that preparation? I mean, had they written it down?
The police, I had access to a tremendous amount of police records in the early part of my research. The biggest source of it was CBI, the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, which became the repository for all the police records that had gone back and forth between all the agencies. And when I first started looking into this, they were all stored at the CBI's Western Region office, and they basically had, in 2007, with the discovery of the Jason McVean, the last suspect, they had basically put all those in banker boxes. There were three banker boxes, large ones, taped them with red tape and shoved them away. So when I came in, those were all set on. I was parked in a conference room for several days. The boxes were all set on the table. They broke the tape and said, go to it. And so I had total access to just all the records. And there were a very thorough investigation. Initially, the police had to discover who were these people, you know, and what was it about. And then they had to try, you know, after that, it was, what do we know about them that will help us locate them? And there was a lot of interviews with their acquaintances and friends, and that's where you got to learn about their preparation and the kind of people that they were, all their friends.
What is the best estimate about how long they lasted?
Well, it really varies. If you listen to police, they would say, well, first of all, I'll give you somewhat of a time frame of when they were found. One was found 1 week after the initial crime. He was found near Blanding, Utah, or Bluff, near Bluff, Utah, in an area of the San Juan River called Swinging Bridge. The next suspect's remains were found 19 months after the crime, and the last one was found in 2007, 9 years after the crime. Police, realizing that this was basically a failure as a manhunt for the police. They had basically blown it. And so the story that I think is saves face most for them is that these suspects all were dead within a day. They'd all killed themselves because they were so harassed by all the police and that they just felt they had to give up and they killed themselves. That is really a long stretch. These people were well ahead of the police. They cruised into that desert. They were drinking beer in the truck as they fled in the final part of the chase. They had so far pulled ahead of the police. They were not being harried at all. Once into the desert, they were into an environment in which they were fully comfortable and could live indefinitely, and actually some of them, that was their dream, to live as hermits in the desert. So they were fully comfortable in the desert. There's no indication that police had ever gotten close to them in the total time of the pursuit. In addition, there had been some sightings that police had kept following up on, going out for about 2 years until finally the sightings died out. So how long they actually lasted, in the book you'll find, I think, an answer to two of that, and to two of them. And the third one, Jason McVean, he was 26 when he committed this crime. On his remains, they have two different methods they're fairly accurate. They can give a age range of somebody when they died. And they gave the age range as 30 to 40 years old. And that includes their margin of error. So if that was the case, then he would have been out there at least 4 years. Okay.
I was actually out of the country when all this happened. But so is it just your theory that they committed suicide, or?
Well, it's not my theory that they committed suicide. My theory is that they were killed. And when you read the book, I think you'll agree. I think that the evidence is overwhelming. And in fact, some of the people, the pathologists, pretty much would agree with that assessment too.
I haven't read it, like I said, I know really nothing about it, but it kind of makes me want to agree already, because you said that they had the means to live out there for a while, and
They had supplies, and that they could have lived out there for years.
Right. Yeah. So it would perplex me why they would even think that they committed suicide.
I think it was an easy answer, and as I said, I think there's some face saving involved with that answer, saying, "Oh, we had these three so harried that they just gave up and killed themselves," when in fact they just weren't. They weren't close to them. Yeah. There are, I think there's three possible scenarios, and I talk about each of them, and I try to give the reasons for each of those three scenarios. To some lot of degree, I lay this out. The mystery exists. I suggest answers. I don't claim to solve it. I just try to give what is the most reasonable answer. Of the three, I mean, it's possible, you know, you take the first theory, did they kill each other? Or did, at least up until the last person. That would certainly be something you'd have to say, well, is that a possibility? There's also had been some talk that there had been some vigilante action there by citizens in that area. Then there is also the possibility, and it was, in fact, something that the FBI had looked at kind of unofficially a couple years after the whole event, that were there, was there a police involved in killing him? You have to remember that this manhunt was total chaos. People were arriving too fast to even assign them into the desert. Some guys would show up from some place, they'd go off on their own. Radio frequencies did not work in the canyons. They couldn't communicate to each other. Some were didn't have enough water with them, had to be rescued by helicopters. Others were lost, and people had to go find them. It was a total chaos, the whole manhunt. So could there possibly have been police who were not under control? That's possible, too. It's very possible.
They,
yes.
You know.
Yeah.
They didn't want it to get back to them. And
yeah. There. This definitely brought a lot of intrusion into the militia culture, which was very pervasive in that part of the country. One of the things that struck me when I first started going through the records was how pervasive the militia culture was. At first, when police were, they described the three suspects in camouflage and automatic weapons, and so it brought militia to mind. And that's what the public knew, and they were hoping for tips. And they got tips by the hundreds and hundreds. And so many of the tips were, my family and I were camping at Black Steer Canyon, and a bunch of men in camouflage with weapons, threatened us away. Or I was over here and fishing, and there were guys over here shooting and playing war games. And it was a great number of these tips. And it struck me. I thought, my goodness, there's a lot of these people out there. Yeah.
Did anybody ever figure out what the manhunt cost?
Well, I don't think it was totaled completely. It was in the millions of dollars. Definitely decimated the budgets for several departments, including the Navajo police. They were really had spent a great deal of money on it. I don't know if there was ever a figure from the FBI. One of the things that was interesting was the amount of resources that the FBI could bring in. On the afternoon of the day that Dale Claxton was killed, the FBI arrived in town, and they arrived with trucks. They unloaded, they commandeered a big part of the Cortez Police Department, and all the other officers, even the CBI officers who were there, were just kind of drop-jawed at the amount of resources. They started wheeling off copy machines, and secretaries arrived, and blackboards. I mean, it was just massive, the amount of equipment they could bring in. So, the other interesting aspect of the story, I thought, was there was a question on whether how the Governor Romner at the time stretched, if not outright violated, the Posse Comitatus Act when he authorized the...
who did you say did that?
Romner.
Romer. Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you said Romney.
No, Romney. No.
Roman Roy.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. When he authorized the use of U.S. Army Special Forces there.
Wow.
So.
Did CBI let you make copies of the documents? Or
yes. That, I mean, it was just like, here it is. Go to the, I mean, I was feeling guilty about the amount of paper I was using from them because I was just going through reams of their paper. And then on top of that, you know, through Freedom of Information Act, I got the FBI records, which were heavily redacted. I mean, it was just a lot of black marks. But for every FBI record, I had the unredacted version that I had gotten from CBI. So. But CBI closed the door when I came back a second time. After, you know, I was further along, had contacted several people, and, you know, I think, you know, I think they might have gotten anxious about it. And so when I came back the second time, they said no.
So have you gotten a response from the book that you've written?
No, this is just out this week, so... Nothing right now. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.